Hello, folks. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds, and I have Time Magazine for you today. This is week one of our biweekly issue, so I'll be reading you the cover stories. The cover story this week is Distress Signal, what the LA fires reveal about America's bleak climate future. This is by Justin Worland in Altadena, California. Looking back, my elementary school experience felt almost bucolic. My classmates and I ran around St. Mark's School's 5.5-acre campus, carefree and with classrooms opening to the outdoors. We sat outside for lunch in the shadow of the San Gabriel Mountains and feared being sent to the administration building, a two-story house converted into offices. The smell of burning forest was a recognizable, if not frequent, occurrence. Teachers would cancel recess, lunch was moved inside from the patio, an annoyance no more ominous than a rainy day. When I visited in February, just a month after the Eaton Fire had ripped through the town of Altadena, California, the campus had been transformed for the most part. The buildings were gone. A chimney from the old house remained standing. A stairwell that once led from the ground floor of the Art Barn to offices upstairs had become a stairwell from nowhere to nowhere. And somehow, amid the rubble, sat the same blue and yellow tables where I hung out nearly three decades prior. In September, I visited St. Mark's again. The campus had been cleared of debris, the result of a cleanup effort that the state touts as the fastest in history. And the site now looks like a giant dirt patch, waiting for construction to begin. In the interim, the school relocated to a corner of a high school 2 miles southeast. It's at once a hopeful and devastating sight. Modular trailers have been placed on the edge of campus. Children are playing in a hastily constructed playground. Amid the faculty walking around, I spot a few familiar places who greet me with hugs and nostalgia. And the blue and yellow tables have been moved to a patio at the center of campus. When we opened this facility, the kids cried. They were like, "Those are our tables," Jennifer Talbert, the head of the school, told me as we walked on the new campus. Talbert is resilient. She talks about how the fire has forced the school to innovate. She says it can emerge from the tragedy stronger. But Talbert, whose home also burned in the fire, acknowledges the uphill battle ahead. Enrollment has declined by a third, and it will be years before a rebuild can be completed, assuming that she can raise the necessary funds. The schools didn't plan for an event of this magnitude. No one did. The Eaton Fire, much like the Palisades Fire, that simultaneously ripped through another Los Angeles community 25 miles away, was at once shocking and entirely predictable. Fires are a constant threat in Southern California, and recent climate conditions mean even steeper challenges than normal. Last year, the region slipped into a drought after 2 years of heavy rainfall, so in January, there was a dead tinder ready to burn. These conditions persist today. It's exactly the sort of erratic environment that comes with a warming planet. Combining the dry vegetation with high wind speeds, typical for January, and the disasters await. But it's precisely those factors that make the fires so shocking. a foreseeable event for any climatologist, yet apparently not for the officials charged with protecting the communities. Firefighters were stretched thin, hydrants ran dry, and evacuation sources came too late. I made my first trip to LA 2 days after the fire started, landing at LAX airport to the shriek of emergency alerts buzzing on phones across the cabin and staying at a hotel packed with a mix of first responders, evacuees, and media. Since then, I've made 7 more trips to LA to track the recovery and spend time in Altadena, the Pacific Palisades, and the places in between where decisions are being made. It's become clear that if the initial response was botched, then the recovery has been interminably slow. As the process drags, a leadership vacuum has emerged. The state says the federal government needs to disperse funds to help cover the bills as it has in the past. The federal government says the state needs to take responsibility. Local government is divided between centers of gravity. In this context, business and nonprofit leaders are trying to address a challenge of unprecedented scale. With no one in the driver's seat, communities, residents, local business owners, school principals, even, have been left to navigate a web of challenges. The January fires that hit Los Angeles are, when taken together, among the costliest disasters in U.S. history, with some estimates of the economic toll topping $250 billion. Some 16,000 structures were destroyed, and at peak, 200,000 people were hit with evacuation orders and warnings. More than 30 people died. Yet the fires have become a distant memory on the national agenda, just as happened with the recent events stretching from North Carolina to Texas. As climate-related disasters accelerate and compound across the country, communities of all political stripes, socioeconomic compositions, and racial backgrounds face new risks. The best way to protest against this is to take action beforehand, investing in programs that help cities prevent and prepare an approach known in climate circles as adaptation. When disaster does strike, the government needs to embrace a new framework for recovery that moves swiftly without leading to rebuilding the exact same way. The recovery in Los Angeles is an opportunity to create a new model for a climate-resilient future. The jury is still out on whether this is possible, and the evidence isn't looking good. The LA fires and their aftermath should serve as a warning sign for us all. In an age of instant communication, the first whiff of the East Eaton fire came through an old-fashioned phone tree, a call from my mother in New York to say that a fire had been spotted in the foothills a few miles from our childhood home and our parents were preparing to evacuate. For months following, my mother kept recounting the details of that night, the initial disbelief that the difficulty navigating an evacuation amid a blackout, and the regret for the lifetime of family memorabilia she couldn't save. While their house, my childhood home, burned to the ground, my parents were among the lucky ones. Our home was located east of Lake Avenue, the thoroughfare that divides East and West Altadena, an area where notifications came early in the evening, a notice to prepare to evacuate, followed by an evacuation order. On the other side where many Black and Latino families had bought homes when redlining kept them out of other neighborhoods, residents went to bed with no indication of the approaching danger. Evacuation orders began at 3:25 a.m., at which point many homes had already caught fire. Residents banged on their neighbors' doors. 19 people died in the Eaton fire, all but one of whom lived west of Lake. "We never got any calls from the sheriff. We never saw a fireman," says Lyanne Hansen Miller, an artist whose home was one of the few still standing on her block. "It was really the encouragement of our neighbors that got us to evacuate." With no one enforcing any restrictions on movement, many residents returned in the morning to see for themselves, sending videos and photos to friends and neighbors. Firefighters stood by perplexed as homes burned because fire hydrants had no water, the result of low water pressure caused by stress on the system. Emergency vehicles zoomed with sirens blasting. The scene was framed by a fog of thick, toxic smoke. How the fire was managed may be considered an original sin that sowed distrust and made the recovery much harder. Lawsuits related to that night abound. And some residents have gone as far as harassing firefighters, the typical heroes of any emergency on the street. Ahead of Halloween, a diorama on an Altadena property displayed a series of skeletons holding signs like "Fire Department Failed Altadena." Over and over, victims I spoke with kept coming back to the horror of that night and the government's failure, even with our conversations had moved on. Neither the Palisades nor Altadena was a rogue frontier settlement. How could they be left to burn? The frustration isn't just anecdotal. An independent report about both fires commissioned by Los Angeles County offered damning conclusion after damning conclusion. The Office of Emergency Management was under-resourced. The county's policy on evacuation warnings was unclear, and first responders relied on old tech that left them with outdated information and unable to communicate with each other reliably. Local officials speak of the unique challenge of that night: the high wind, multiple fires that stretched sources thin, and so on. But no one offers a full-throated defense of the initial response. "We didn't have the technology or the staffing to meet the needs of how catastrophes like this fire was," Catherine Barger, the county supervisor who represents Altadena, put it to me bluntly. The notifications were a failure. At a national or even global level, a rich body of literature shows that a relatively small investment to adapt to the effects of climate change pays enormous dividends. Exact numbers vary, but some estimates suggest that a dollar invested in resilience can result in up to $10 in avoided costs and economic benefits. But even in high-risk places, these investments tend to be placed on the back burner. It's hard to cut a ribbon on training for fighting wildfires. And when all is going well, the public don't demand it. In LA, the cost of additional firefighter training, early warning systems, and improved water infrastructure would save billions, not to mention lives, disruption, and heartache. In September, I drove up Lake Avenue to meet Sean Dawson Beer, one of the most outspoken locals spearheading recovery ideas. At first, the storefronts conveyed a staid sense of normalcy, not too different from what I remember growing up. But as I kept driving, the view quickly transformed into a tattered landscape of cleared lots and lingering debris. The homes on Dawson Deere's block, just west of Lake Avenue, were all gone, though on the corner, two women carried on a normal conversation, as they had just bumped into each other on a neighborhood stroll. On Dawson Beer's lot, the first inkling of apple trees were sprouting up from the cleared dirt. Dawson Beer, who runs a private Facebook group for Altadena residents that counts more than 10,000 members, has an extensive list of fixes that she thinks will help the area regain footing, from soil testing to ensure the land isn't laced with toxic contaminants, to new financial structures to help people afford to build. But perhaps the most important idea is a call for Altadena to become an independent city, a tall order at any time, but especially in the midst of fire recovery. To effectively build back, she says, Altadena must break free from the existing power structure. We need to steer our own ship, she tells me. The destruction of Altadena spawned an array of advocates and activists. Altadena was a diverse community, home to everyone from self-proclaimed starving artists to white shoe corporate lawyers. Many NASA scientists called the town home, thanks to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory nearby. In some areas, multiple generations occupied a small, single-family home that had been in the family for decades. Elsewhere, giant mansions sat within walking distance to the local country club. Unsurprisingly, views about what the recovery should look like varied widely. At the Home State Taco Shop, part of a commercial strip a few blocks from any visible fire damage, I met Allie Rachel Pearl, an assistant professor who was leading a nonprofit community land trust that works with another nonprofit to turn properties into new housing, green space, or commercial spaces that meet local needs. And for owners who feel forced to sell, the organization helps to keep the land locally owned. So far, however, 2/3 of properties sold have been bought by investors, according to research from UCLA. To me, the North Star is anti-displacement, she says. After attending a fire recovery meeting, I chatted with Joy Chen about the Eaton Fire Surveyors Network. Chen, an Altadena resident who formerly worked as a deputy mayor in the city of Los Angeles, founded the group to advocate for fire victims and quickly focused on insurance issues. Few policies covered the full cost of rebuilding, the consequence of rising construction cost, and policies that didn't adjust. Many victims say that insurance companies are taking too long to pay out. Others say insurers are shortchanging them. To me, a healthy insurance market requires that companies honor their contracts, says Chen. Other activists are targeting issues with soil remediation. Officials say that they completed the cleanup in record time. Locals complain that the government was less comprehensive in its efforts to test the soil for toxic materials than it has been in past disasters. A different group focuses on resources for centers who have slipped through the cracks, many of them recovery programs. Another helps equip small businesses with the means to reopen. Even for someone intimately familiar with the texture of the community, it can be hard to keep track of the proliferation of ideas, organizations, and approaches in the wake of the fires. This dynamic is a reflection of both the community's diversity and a widely shared commitment to a locally led rebuilding effort. Without a doubt, the influx of philanthropic support, local organization, tens of millions of dollars in a matter of weeks after the fire has also helped sustain the various efforts. But it's also the result of a lack of institutional leadership. As a census-designated, unincorporated community, Altadena has no mayor. Its population before the fire hovered at around 43,000. Barger, the most prominent elected official, represents 2 million people across the county and lives in a different city a few miles away. And yet even in the Palisades, which, unlike Altadena, is part of the city of Los Angeles, it faces similar challenges. It's one dot on the western edge of the city, and there too power is distributed between the city and county authorities. Powerful locals with Palisades connections include Rick Caruso, a billionaire real estate developer who ran against Mayor Karen Bass in the last election, create a whole different set of fractured dynamics. The challenge of Los Angeles' balkanized government is no secret to local leadership. A few months into the fire, a group of local leaders on a blue ribbon commission proposed by the county supervisor representing the Palisades released a report that suggested creating a unified authority to coordinate rebuilding across the county. The authorities could help to arrange bulk purchase of materials, create new finance mechanisms to facilitate the rebuilding, and even buy property across the affected locales, thereby keeping the bottom from falling out. And the report called for the city and county to adopt climate adaptation measures to ensure that the affected areas are prepared for future disasters. It really was a vision for what our entire region could look like in terms of a resilient and fire-safe recovery, says Matt Peterson, the head of the Los Angeles Clean Tech Incubation, who chaired the commission. The recommendations were perhaps visionary. Bass opposed creating a new entity. Barger opposed an effort in Sacramento to authorize, but she said that she supported the idea of a rebuilding authority structured differently. In the meantime, they both worked to expedite permitting the city of Los Angeles, accelerating permission for fire area projects, and expediting pre-approved home plans. The county has set up one-stop help desks and waived fees. Where I've been laser-focused is looking at where the impediments are, where the barriers are, and addressing them, says Barger. New construction will inevitably be built to higher standards. Some homes destroyed across Los Angeles were built as early as the 1920s, and the building code has since required fire-resistant materials. The relevant jurisdictions are also enforcing a policy that requires keeping landscaping away from structure. But is that enough? Rebuilding LA offers an opportunity to the truly proactive and creative when it comes to climate adaptation. Yet that sort of deep thinking is still not at the center of how most people are talking about recovery. I first met Stephen Sacks at a big investor conference 4 months after the fires in LA. While his house had survived the Eaton fire, he had scrambled to find business attire for the conference because of the stench of smoke lingering in his clothes. Like so many Altadena residents, I met Sacks. He seemed shell-shocked, but eager to do his part. In his Substack newsletter, Alta Policy Wonk, he has documented and opined on the political wrangling happening in the city, Sacramento, and Washington, D.C. His audience is small, but it's a must-read for locals engaged in rebuilding conversations. For much of the year, he promoted his proposal solutions, which are a financial mechanism that would allow investors to fund nonprofit purchasing property in fire-affected areas. The properties would then be sold on the open market in a controlled fashion, thereby stabilizing property values and prioritizing homeowners. Perhaps more than any other issue, finance is at the center of the recovery effort. Local public infrastructure needs to be rebuilt at an estimated cost of $2 billion. Many property owners face a gap between their insurance payouts and the cost of rebuilding. Meanwhile, declining property values reflected in sale prices as more people cash out have left many locals unsure about their ability to get a mortgage. A proposed legal settlement from Southern California Edison, the electric utility widely blamed for sparking the Eaton fire, will go a long way, but for some it may not be enough. Despite offering the settlement, Edison has not accepted responsibility. If Sachs's fix sounds wonky, it's because it is. And even though he worried with the local assembly member to introduce the bill, and it eventually passed the legislature, California Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed it in October, saying it would cost tens of millions of dollars. Sachs, a self-identified political independent who regularly supports Democrats, disputes those figures and notes that it's a small fraction of the $321 billion state budget. He has been withering in his criticism of Newsom. In his telling, the governor has focused on needling President Trump to the detriment of Californians who need help. Altadena became a test case without realizing it, caught between the macro-level trends that are affecting people in ways they never should have, says Sachs, referring to the broader political landscape. Newsom and the state government have taken credit for a speedy response, unlocking $2.5 billion in state dollars for immediate relief efforts. State officials are keen to tout the state's role in facilitating a quick cleanup and easing environmental permitting rules. The state, however, insists that the federal government must step up. In February, Newsom asked Congress for nearly $40 billion in federal aid to help rebuild Los Angeles after the fires. It would be an understatement to say that Congress and the Trump administration have other priorities. While disaster relief has become increasingly politicized, the federal government doled out tons of billions in special funding in a matter of weeks following the previous disaster, like Hurricane Katrina. Funding for disaster recovery this year, however, has received minimal attention on Capitol Hill, even as congressional watchers hope to include some relief, a must-pass legislation later this year. There's no pure substitution for federal engagement and leadership, California Natural Resources Secretary Wade Crowfoot told me when asked how the state can fill the gap in federal funding. The leadership vacuum is almost by design. Upon taking office, Trump has talked about dismantling the Federal Emergency Management Agency in hopes of putting the onus of disaster recovery on states. The move has left hard-hit communities in the lurch, And it's not just California. Disaster affected communities in North Carolina, Texas, and elsewhere have unmet assistance needs. Trump also denies the science of climate change and any connection between global temperatures and the associated storms, fires, and floods. Science expect the scale of climate disasters to grow. Without investment to minimize the damage, the price tag of those disasters will grow too. Unchecked climate costs are unsustainable for any government, even the world's largest economy. Trump's policy's logic seems to be that given these costs could grow exponentially, it's best to pass the buck to the states. Any rational economic actor knows that something must be done, even if the government is unable or unwilling to take the lead. Disasters pose risks to the local economy. Thousands of businesses were located in the burn area of the Eaton and Palisades fires. History suggests that many may never reopen. And while historically the economic impact of disasters has been relatively isolated, a growing body of research warns that climate disasters could damage the wider economy. Insurers will pull out of some places. Mortgages owned by investors are threatened, and the market for municipal bonds could be spooked. It makes sense that banks are assessing ways to participate in the recovery. The Altadena Recovery and Rebuild Corporation, a nonprofit initiated by Barger, is engaging with banks on new lending programs to make financing the recovery more affordable for affected homeowners. The details are still under development. Well-established global institutions are trying to figure out a path forward, too. If you pull all the resources, there's absolutely enough capital, says Barger. The question is, what is that going to look like? These efforts are important. But as LA approaches the one-year fire anniversary, they are moving too slowly. On the ground, consternation is brewing. Local activists in Altadena have staged press conferences and rallies decrying the local, state, and federal responses, calling for the insurance commissioner to resign and demanding new county oversight, among other things. In the Palisades, too, residents have grown frustrated, flocking to town halls to condemn the LA fire response. Jake Levine, a former climate official in the Biden White House, whose mother lost her home in the Palisades fire, is now running to unseat the local Democrat who has served in Congress for decades. Levine says the fires have contributed to resentment that government isn't working. Whether you're in the Palisades and still struggling to find a path forward on a rebuild, or whether you're anywhere in our district and you're dealing with an affordability crisis, a public safety crisis, we have an absent leadership that has forgotten how to deliver, he says. Nationally, much of the coverage of this year's fires has boiled down to two simple narratives. In the Palisades, wealthy celebrities lost their homes. In Altadena, middle-income black and brown people with less means to get back on their feet lost their homes. There are elements of truth to these narratives. Climate-related events will always be harder to weather for those with fewer resources. But sometimes, fear that these narratives obscure an important reality. Climate disaster will strike everywhere. Whatever protection you may think you have, it's best to think again. Maintain a healthy society in the time of climate crisis. Someone needs to take the wheel. While the day-to-day of insurance, soil, and fire planning occupy headlines, the bigger picture has been lost. Climate change may not be an existential threat in the sense that it will kill us all, but it is existential for the cultural fabric of communities. And climate disasters threaten to bring about political and social fragmentation for the growing number of people affected by them. It won't be known until 3 or 4 years from now when the reality sets in, says Sachs. When people look around and say, all these communities existed, and now they're all gone. On my last trip in October to Altadena, I decided to do laps through the streets in my rental car, looking for any tidbits that might help inform my reporting. There were signs of life, fences with construction company signs, in some places, even a few lots with equipment buzzing, properties with trailers placed in the corner as residents readied themselves for the long haul. But what struck me most were the little American flags installed on street after street of vacant lots. One house, still standing on Catherine Street, 2 blocks west of Lake, displayed a large one, only they placed it upside down, the international symbol for distress. And this story is with reporting by Leslie Dickinson. Folks, you're listening to Sun Sounds. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon reading Time Magazine, and we are now moving forward to the next feature story in this week's Time Magazine, and the title is A Losing Game. In simulations across the country, students are proving that we aren't ready for the next pandemic. And this is by Dominique Rosenberg. On a Friday in October, about 100 high school and college students gathered in a Utah ballroom to play a game. Some students were assigned specific roles and given costumes to wear. Government officials slung over their t-shirts. Store clerks sported aprons. And a triad of journalists wore fedoras and carried fake microphones. Cambry Carlisle, 16, played a healthcare worker and was given full protective gear to wear, including goggles and gloves. As students started getting sick with a mysterious and deadly pathogen, panic surged, Carlisle said. It wasn't a real scenario, but people still got very frantic. Students thronged the healthcare and public health stations for advice and vaccines, ignoring calls by workers to socially distance. The infected student ran around intentionally coughing on people, causing panic. One of the journalists, 17-year-old Kenali Burlingame, complained that it had been hard at times to get anyone to listen to her. The public health people told us that we need to start getting people to quarantine, but I felt like no one really did that. They didn't see the importance of it, she says, and that was frustrating. Meanwhile, the biomedical researchers who donned white lab coats and were tasked with identifying the pathogen were baffled by the myriad symptoms that sick people were reporting, including fever, aching muscles, and malaise. Could be anything, one of them lamented, as she Googled people's symptoms and uncovered a long list of possible diseases. The students were playing Operation Outbreak, a game that simulates the spread of an infectious disease. During the game, participants use an app on their phones, which alerts them when their avatars are infected and lists their symptoms. The pathogen spreads via Bluetooth from phone to phone. Creators of the game said that it can model how people really behave when disease outbreaks strike. The game has become so good at this that the U.S. government agencies, including the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, have run its simulations. In Utah, students who weren't given specific roles were designated as members of the public and grouped together in families. The families moved around the room together, visiting stations where they had to answer questions about infectious diseases and public health. The bank paid the family in tokens for correct answers. The tokens could be used by the students to buy food from the store to keep their avatars alive, as well as masks and vaccines. I thought it'd just be a little school activity, but it was realistic, says Burlingame. It made me feel sympathetic for people during COVID. Burlingame was in fifth grade when COVID first gripped the globe in 2020. I just remember that one day I was at school and everything was normal, and then the next day, the world had shut down, she says. She remembered being almost apocalyptic at first, the same week that Utah public schools were shuttered. The Salt Lake City area where she lives was shaken by an earthquake and dozens of aftershocks. Burlingame, then only 11, was spooked. Some 5,400 people died from COVID in Utah from 2020 to November of 2023. The teenager is prudent when reflecting on that tumultuous time. There could be another outbreak, she says. And what would we do about it? The creators of Operation Outbreak say that the game is designed precisely to address this question. It seeks to teach students about the science and risks of infectious diseases and how interventions such as vaccines and quarantining can curb their spread, says Todd Brown, a former middle school teacher and one of the game's creators. It also aims to highlight the vital role that every member of society, whether scientist, doctor, government official, or everyday person, plays when outbreaks strike. This is a test run, Brown says. This is a chance for students to learn how they can potentially save lives, how they could help stop the spread of something in their school or community. Upping the urgency for such preparedness is the prediction by many public health experts that another pandemic is not just inevitable, but close at hand. We need to be prepared for another pandemic in the next 10 years, says Pardis Sabelti, an infectious disease professor at Harvard University and researcher in the Broad Institute who helped to create Operation Outbreak. COVID was still a distant, unknown threat when the game launched in 2017. Versions of it have since been played by thousands of students in 24 United States states and 10 countries. Its creators say interest in the game increased sharply after COVID. We found that the students tell us the zeitgeist. They tell us the pulse of society, everything that might be coming, Sabetti says. We could have predicted a lot of what happened during COVID based on simulations that we did pre-pandemic. In some cases, students who had roles of authority disseminated information about the outbreak that later proved to be wrong, often because they spoke too soon in response to public pressure or because new information later became available. That showed students how science can change as you get new information, says Brown, the former teacher who now serves as Operation Outbreak's Director of Innovation and Training. But the fluctuations in messaging often triggered malcontent among members of the community. Game organizers say that mistrust of officials, scientists, and journalists has only become more common in simulations post-COVID. Participants are also more prone to unruly behavior. At some of the schools, we've seen complete societal breakdown, anarchy and militia, Sabetti says, and that was despite students taking the game seriously. These are things that hadn't been seen before COVID, Sabetti said. She recalls, for example, a March 2024 simulation at a Utah high school that ended in total chaos. After the government struggled to fund health agencies and researchers were slow to identify the pathogen, disorder and misinformation swelled. A journalist spread fake news about masking. People began stealing from the store, and a government official went rogue, robbing the bank and throwing tokens at a crowd. "I represent government intervention," he declared, according to an internal report of the simulation compiled by game organizers and shared with Time. "Money to the people." Amid the bedlam, participants called for a police force to reestablish a jail, and a jail was created. The government official who stole from the bank was impeached. About an hour into the simulation, the new police force issued arrest warrants for multiple people, including someone who sold fake vaccines to make a profit, said the report. At 80 minutes, as the simulation came to an end, the report said several students were running and fighting each other, some arresting others. "It scared me," said Sabetti. "It suggests that society has formed antibodies to the idea of an outbreak. People are easily triggered, so the next time someone comes on television and says we're having a lockdown, we could see militia and anarchy." Since the COVID pandemic, Americans have lost faith in previously respected institutions. Almost 1 in 4 U.S. adults said in 2024 that they had little or no confidence that scientists would act in the best interests of the public, according to a Pew Research Center survey. In 2019, that figure was 1 in 8. Only 22% of Americans said they trusted the federal government to do the right thing always or most of the time, according to a different survey from 2024. "We need to do a lot to repair, because when the next pandemic hits, we will be in trouble," Sabetti says. Pandemics are expected to occur more often and become more deadly because of climate change, globalization, and more frequent encounters between people and billions of livestock that we raise to eat, as well as the animals whose habitats we have diminished, public health experts say. "It's going to be less of a freak biological occurrence and more like hurricanes, which are increasing and becoming more devastating," says Jennifer Nuzzo, director of Brown University's Pandemic Center. "It's hard to predict which pathogens could launch the next global health crisis, but infectious disease experts say they're closely watching various outbreaks worldwide for signs of pandemic potential. A rapidly mutating strain of Mpox continues to spread across Africa and beyond. Avian flu strains are circulating in livestock and poultry, with some spillover in people. A manufactured pathogen is also a danger," Sabetti says. "Thanks to advances in biotechnology and AI, a single rogue actor can now feasibly create a bio threat, and because of that, anything is possible," she says. Operation Outbreak was first conceived in 2015. Ebola was ravaging West Africa, and Brown was a civics teacher in Florida middle school. One day, a student in his class asked what would happen if Ebola came to the United States. I responded honestly. I said, "I have no idea," Brown recalls. "So I posed the question back to the class, and we had this exciting discussion." Encouraged by his students' enthusiasm, Brown brainstormed ways to further engage them on the subject of infectious diseases. It was a topic that was deeply personal to him. Brown's son is severely immunocompromised, and outbreaks, including the yearly flu season, terrify his family. Brown had recently read a profile of Sabetti, who had helped develop tools to detect and track deadly diseases, including Ebola, in an issue of Time. Brown emailed her, and the pair ended up on the phone. He told her that he was planning to put together a simple outbreak simulator so his students could get some hands-on experience. Sabetti, who had herself experimented with outbreak simulations in her Harvard class, asked him to stay in touch. A few months later, Brown assembled some middle schoolers in field and using stickers to indicate who they had been infected and attempted to simulate what an Ebola outbreak might look like. It wasn't very sophisticated, but the kids loved it, Brown says. I teached back out to the paradise with pictures, and it all kind of snowballed from there. Sabetti says that she saw an opportunity to create something fun, educational, and sorely needed. Her lab set about designing an Operation Outbreak app that could realistically mimic an outbreak. Andres Colubri, a researcher in her lab, had been working on counter-tracing software, which he adapted so that it could be used as part of the app to spread hypothetical pathogens via Bluetooth. With the help of data visualization expert Ben Fry, the group also created a dashboard that could display data generated during the simulation, including contact tracing data and the number of people infected and vaccinated. The tools made up for the app are the same tools we are creating for outbreaks around the world. Students are working with her in-class technology, Sabetti says. Operation Outbreak is free to use and has been played by school children from Shanghai to Sierra Leone to Paris and Toronto. Organizers can choose from a variety of possible pathogens to simulate, from coronaviruses and measles to Marburg virus and tuberculosis. Kian Sani, Operation Outbreak's chief of staff, says the hope is to bring to the simulation to more professional groups in the near future, including public health departments, first responders, and companies that might want to bolster their employees' outbreak preparedness. Teachers who have organized the game say that they like the simulation best because, though outbreak science is not typically taught in the schools, it complements what students are already learning about biology and civics. It helps kids understand the science behind the vaccines and being sick and how research works. But also, it's a great pipeline for careers because they get to see more about the different career paths, says Nicole Kellerman, a biology teacher who has organized Operation Outbreak simulations in two Maryland high schools. Exposure to Operation Outbreak has prompted many students to pursue career paths in public health or research. It also helps students become a little more confident in their ability to relate to what's happening in the world and say, hey, I've been in that position, even if only for an hour. And folks, that does it for Time Magazine today. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about what's happening. We had our two cover stories, and next week I'll read you the Brief and Time articles. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for SunSounds. I've enjoyed reading for you today, and I'll look forward to next time. Have a great week. Bye now.